You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stopped, opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text THIN to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text THIN to 200-300. That's THIN to 200-300. THIN to 200-300.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Welcome to Metalarchus 47, a very special Metalarchus 47. We do not have Kate Fagan, we do not have Amin El-Hassan, but we do instead. We have Adnan Virk, we have Brian Koppelman, because we are here to talk about tennis, and they don't want to talk tennis. They're not going to be able to handle what we're going to talk about right now. And this is Metalarchus 47. We've been talking about the numbers as we approach Metalarchus 50. And we were talking about Metalarchus 47 in terms of who are our 47s. Amin says it's Andrei Kirilenko. I said, you know, you got to go Bruce Hurst with a 47 or a Tommy Glavin 47. But since we are here to talk Roger Federer, we are going to go. Roger Federer has 1,275 wins. Win number 47 was March 3rd, 2007 in Dubai against Mikhail Yuzny. I'm sure you all remember that. Brian, welcome. Adnan, welcome.
Howard, great to be with both you guys. Obviously, Howard, always loved your work. I'm glad we're finally chatting. Next time we talk, we need to talk, you know, about our mutual love of jazz. You know, not many people, you know, are talking baseball, tennis, and jazz. So you,
I didn't know you were a jazz guy.
Yeah. And I got to tell Koppelman, I've told him this off air, but the podcast he did with Bill Simmons, absolutely hysterical talking about misery. Particularly, Brian, you got to tell this audience the story about Stephen King, the way he would ration four cigarettes throughout the day. Amazing.
Yeah, well, they can go and listen to that episode of The Rewatchables. Let's keep this. Let's keep this right here. Let's keep it here. I'm thrilled to be here with you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a special Roger Federer pod. I did not know. I believe that you are both complete Fed guys. 100% Fed. What was your reaction, Brian, when you first heard that Roger was officially calling it quits?
Yeah, I had been really, I'd been dreading it. You know, it took me for a long, long time. I wouldn't even hear the argument that either of the other two dudes were the best in history because, and I've talked to many, Howard, you and I have talked about this. We texted about it. I don't know if you remember. We've had this conversation during various times when the Grand Slam title thing was going back and forth, and in consideration of Nadal's head-to-head advantage. For me, Fed is the most, and it seems like everyone says this, and it almost like these words just wash over you because they're spoken so often, but it is the truth. He's the most graceful and beautiful and perfect tennis player who ever lived. Every single thing about the way that person is built for and worked to become the perfect tool for tennis. From the way he would dress, to the way his clothes fit him, to the way he walked onto the court and warmed up, to his actual strategic and tactical approach to the game, was a transcendently beautiful thing to watch. And, you know, you briefly mentioned jazz. I'm probably not a fanatic like the two of you, but there is something about, like, Bill, the way Bill Evans played piano or Max Roach played the drums, and the singular individuals who did something in a graceful way that was also incredibly powerful, and that's Fed.
And in this time of STEM, I do have to say, I love the fact that everyone who talks about Roger Federer, we do bring art into it. There is still room for art in this world, isn't there? It's not just number crunch, number crunch. I know, Adnan, you are there in the home of exit velocity and and hard hit rate and the rest of it. But we're talking art right now.
100%. Like, you know, the three of us could start batting around the numbers, and the 310 weeks at number one, 237 consecutive weeks, you know, the 8 Wimbledons, 6 Aussies, 5 US Opens. Howard's right. My brain definitely goes to the numbers and I try to go in that direction. How about the fact the most hard court wins ever, most grass court wins ever, 103 on the ATP Tour, only 6 behind Connors. But it really is the artistry. And I think in some ways, as depressed as I was and as saddened as I was when I got the news yesterday, I did find it fitting that it was on the same day as Roberto Clemente Day throughout baseball. Because I said, Clemente is a guy you could often talk about, the 4-time batting champion, the 12-time gold glover. But it's obviously his humanitarian work, the way he carried himself, and the artistry with which he played baseball, with which he was a 5-tool player. He could inspire others, particularly the Latino community, to be the best they could be. And Federer, in many ways, you know, had that balletic grace about him, what Brian was talking about. The word that I think that is often underutilized when it comes to athletes, because you can't often say it about most of them, is elegance. You know, there was a real elegance about Federer and the way he carried himself both on the court and off, right? Never broke a sweat, always seemed to be in control. And I think in some ways it was to his detriment, because people thought, oh, it's just so easy for him because he's so phlegmatic. And I said, no, you're missing the point. But what gets underappreciated about Federer is his grit and how tough he was, and the fact he would grind out these wins. He's got the most wins ever in history when being down 2 sets. He did it 10 times, being on 2 sets, being able to rally the deficit. Like, that's amazing. He's got the most wins ever when fighting off match point, did it 20 times. And I think that's what sometimes gets underappreciated, the fact this guy, just because he looked like James Bond, and he was, you know, never shaken nor stirred, it's misleading because he was as competitive as anybody out there. And the fact he's leaving now, this tells you so much about Federer. So many other athletes would want the victory lap. They want to announce this is the last one. They can take the hero's welcome and farewell and bask in the adulation. Not Federer. If I'm not going to win, if I'm not the best out there, I'm not going to bother. It's been a great run. I'm 41 years old. I got 4 beautiful kids. I have a devoted and loving wife, America. I got my parents used to come to every single match. It was such a cute image. His avuncular father wearing his Federer hat. Like, I'm good. There's no ego with Federer, and I think that's the real shock. You know, try to make a comparison to other sports. I mentioned Clemente. I think of Jean Beliveau in hockey. You know, that gracefulness, that elegance, and the humility. Like, athletes, by their very nature, are going to be self-absorbed and egotistical. He's the rare athlete that writers said he would actually ask me about me. We'd have a conversation and say, how are you doing? What's up with you? He'd remember that L. John Wertheim had kids, or whoever writer was following him around, he would actually take an interest in them. So I think it's that generosity of spirit, along with what Brian is saying. The play itself was inspiring, but as a person, he was truly inspirational.
Well, I would just, you know, use the word phlegmatic, which is a great word. for sure. But I actually think that in a way, Borg was more phlegmatic. The thing about Fed as a player is that he would let you in. He would share a little bit of the emotional ride. You could tell he wanted to win, and he would, he wasn't fist pumping as often as Tiger, but, you know, he would involve the crowd and he would let you into his emotions. He wasn't emotionless. Like, to me, he wasn't a cyborg in the way Lendl was, right? Lendl's phlegmatic, but Fed is elegant. For me, is like what you were talking about. And I just, Howard, I want to bring up one thing, which is part of what's, to me, always been incredible, which is, if you're a tennis player, you can't imitate Fed's strokes. Like, everybody can imitate even Nadal's whipped huge forehand. We could all do Connors. We could go generationally, and we understand how to adjust our grip. And Feds, even his forehand, it is only Federer's. Nobody has a forehand like Feds, and nobody has ever had a backhand like Feds. Like, just the technical mastery. You know, I've spent hours watching that kick serve that somebody got from a good angle. It's supposed to teach you the Fed kick serve. And there is an economy of motion, and every single part of it, the form just serves the purpose, and his particular body shape in a way that is inimitable. You can't imitate it. And that he's a true original in the way that he played the game. And then the fact that he was, and it's because the strokes don't look personal. They look like they're almost factory made. They're so perfect. Whereas most people, they're idiosyncratic. Like, they've played something, they do something in a certain way that feels like it's got this, but Fed, it was all such fluidity, right? This beauty and fluidity, maybe like Michael Phelps swimming or something like that, where it's like he's built for this purpose.
Yeah, it's really interesting you should say that. I remember taking a tennis lesson once, and the instructor was trying, he was saying, what do you want to work on? What are the things you're not doing well? And I'm in between you guys. I'm a 4-0, I'm not a 4-5. And I remember talking about how many times I get what I want on serve and then totally destroy the short ball. I destroy the short ball.
The plus one's the hard.
The plus
one. That's the difference. That is the difference. That's the level. The plus one is what you spend so many hours working on, because it drives you crazy when you miss the plus one.
So he's trying to teach me how to do the Federer sort of side cross step. Come on, I'm falling down. I can't do this. And so he's like, just like Fed does. And I'm like, no, not like Fed does. And so he's trying to teach me, you know, go hop on YouTube, the classic Roger Federer sort of cross step forward and then leap off the front foot and then just whip it down. No.
Inimitable. Yeah.
Can't do it. Tried to do it. I'm like, And it reminded me of the great Hemingway line when he was talking about himself in the Ken Burns doc, when they were quoting him saying, I'm just a carpenter hammering nails to a board. That's all I do. And that's like, that's what I'm just trying to get to the ball to try to get it over the net. Do not try to get me to cross step and then glide into the air with the whip going down the line. Forget it. And it is true. I mean, I think that when I think about Fed as a player, this very thing, and full disclosure, this is a Nadal household. I mean, journalistically, I don't talk like that, but this is a Rafa household. And what's funny about it was that I always found Rafa to be a little bit more human simply because Roger's strokes were so clean. They were so clean. They were so, I mean, and I think that this generation, we'll talk about this at some point, but I think this generation, all of them, can say this, and it's what separates them from the newcomers and from the guys that they just vanquished for the last 12 years. All of them have plus, everybody, even Djokovic's overhead, they're all plus strokes. And I think that Roger's the guy who really sort of created that sort of tension, that if you're going to be at this level, everything's got to be good. And you go back to look at somebody like Pete, where, you know, I don't think he got to like one semifinal on clay. Right now, the bar that Roger created, all the strokes had to be plus, all the surfaces had to be plus. The ramping up of what needed to be done to be a champion during this era is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, his game kind of mimicked who he was as a person, right? He had this beautiful balance, it seemed, between work and family. Kids were always with him in tow, wife, kids, etc. And the tennis was also balanced. All parts looked special. If you ask true Fed fans like Brian, okay, what's Federer's best weapon? On some days, I would say, oh, it's his forehand. That forehand winner, when it was rolling, forget about it. But that one flick backhand could be a weapon. I'm going back, I'm watching the greatest match ever played, that 08 Wimbledon, and that one passing shot, Federer hits that backhand, it's ridiculous. And I text Marty Fish, of course, the former great American tennis player, and he goes, most underrated part of Federer's game, it's his serve. He said, no one ever talks about the serve. It's always
I find that hard to believe, because whenever I talk about Federer, I say that if you said to me, okay, give me Karlovic, give me Isner, give me Sampras, give me Serena, whose serve are you? I mean, to me, those are the best serves. Even Karlovic is out because his double faults are higher, right? I mean, you could say that John Isner has the most dominant serve in the history of the sport, but in terms of repeatability and in terms of the what Roger could do. I'm fascinated by anyone talking about his serve. Roger Federer is famous for the 45-second hold. How can that not be? how can that not stem off of the serve? He's not a guy who plays points the way Rafa does to get the point started. Djokovic has a fantastic serve as well, but that came 6 years into his career. Roger's serve is great.
Yeah. Maybe it is the footwork, though. If we think about what ties all of these elements together, in a way, the footwork, the way he moved.
That's the ballet dancer, right?
That's what I'm saying. The way he moved around the court, the way he got himself positioned, right, to execute these strokes with such efficiency.
And it is true. It is the footwork. I mean, when you think about, all of it. Nadal said it the other day at the U.S. Open when he was talking about, what did he say? He said tennis is a sport, after Tiafoe blew him off the court, he'd said something like, tennis is a sport of time and space, right? I was like, oh, goodness. And you have to give yourself space to hit the ball and give yourself the time to do the things you want to do. And you're obviously trying to take time away from the other player. I remember watching him and thinking, he reminds me a lot of being in chess club. If you're not in chess club, right, there's a certain way that you're never going to see the board, right? Unless there's something about this that you catch this at a really early age. And I can just imagine his first instructors when he was 5, 6, 7 years old looking at him going, this kid sees the board. I mean, you know when you're around, and we're all been around professionals, and you know those people who have that genius level thing that you cannot teach. And he's got that. That's not just, I learned how to play tennis. I know how to do this in a way that I can't even explain.
Yeah, it's so smart and so correctly said. Like, I was just thinking about Ohtani. And because Levine and I were in the office the other day talking about when Ohtani sits in the dugout and watches people struggling, it must make no sense to him.
Well, that's like the great Barry Bonds thing in them.
Dave and I were talking about this. Like, it just must, when he sees some guy go up to bat who can't get their bat around or can't make it happen or straight out, and he's talking to his teammates because they all suck except try. Like, it must, he have that gap, that gulf between the way he sees the game, exactly what you're talking about, man. Like, and the way all the mortals see the game, and it's
right.
Golf that he could never understand. It's like, why is this so hard for you guys? This isn't hard. Like, it's not hard.
Hard.
Like, yeah, it's not hard, right? And that's the thing. I think Fed always seemed to me, and I was thinking, why do I always, like, people play that game with movies. I'm sure you do. And I'm like, what movie could you never not turn off? But like, if I click Tennis Channel and Joker's on or Rafa's on and I'm very tired, I'll watch a little bit, but I could turn it off. But when Fed is on there, was on there, because you never knew what approach he was going to take in a given match. You know the approach that Rafa's going to take. You know sort of what the attack is going to be. But Fed could do everything.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean about that plus ability where you're looking at, you're looking at the way that a player is going to approach something and you're like, okay, there are some things he doesn't do well. You can pick on his forehand pick. You can't pick on anything with Roger. If you really, really wanted to quibble with Federer, right? And this is why the conversations always turn into end results instead of just form. It's like, okay, well, who won the most matches at the end? Like, that's the only argument that you can make when you're talking about Federer. Well, eventually, you know, well, Rafa had him from the beginning because it was just a bad matchup for him and Roger just wouldn't switch rackets. And then secondarily, you know, Djokovic ended up catching him at the end, had him early, caught him at the end. You know, the last 10 years or so, Djokovic has had Rogers, you know, he's just been better. He's been tougher. But what nobody quibbles about when you're watching Roger is the elevation of the actual sport. And this is the type of stuff that people don't get when I was talking about Roger being the standard. Like, there are certain people who come in during certain periods of time and they become the standard of how the game is played. And that is a very special thing. And it cannot be underestimated because you do have to ask the question. And Adnan, this is for you. And I'm sure, Brian, I know you've got some thoughts on it. I don't care what anybody says, and I know this is a big moment, and I know I'm not supposed to say it, but I don't care. I'm saying it anyway. I am absolutely f***ing bored by Albert Pujols. I don't care. He's going to hit 700 home runs. He may hit even more than that. He may come back next year. He may not. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer. He's got 2 titles, right? All of the above. I am not interested in this man's game and how he does his business. However, so you cannot reduce Roger Federer just to the aesthetic is a piece of this. The who am I going to watch and why am I watching them? That's a huge piece of this. And I'm sorry, Novak, and even Rafa as well. This guy's the difference maker for the entire generation. And if you want to have another conversation about, well, you know, he's 23 and 27 against Novak. He's, you know, 16 and 24 against Roger. Those are good conversations if you want to have a different GOAT conversation. But if you're talking about this generation, who was the guy who set the tone? It's Roger Federer.
Yeah, I'm not going to defend the lumbering DH who murders lefties. So we'll leave the Pujols conversation where it is. But your point about Roger, he was men's tennis. Like, as you said, he was a standard bearer. He elevated everybody else. And that's where the GOAT conversation, to me, is the most fascinating. Because if you, like you said, if you want to just argue majors, well, that's one metric. That's like saying, you know, Robert Horry is better than whomever because look how many championships he had, or Bill Russell, et cetera. I'm like, yes, majors, it's a complicated issue. As we know, Rod Laver didn't have as many majors as these guys, but you ask tennis fans of a certain age, Rod Laver's the greatest player of all time. The Aussie Open wasn't a major then. Majors.
Yeah, but he does have the stat. I mean, he has the stat because I don't agree with it, but he does have the stat because he has two Grand Slams.
Correct.
Yeah.
He has two of the winning the...
Yeah, he's won the calendar Grand Slam twice.
Twice, won the count. So that statistically is right. Why people make the argument for what that's worth.
It becomes a larger argument, like Howard said. Djokovic caught him near the end. Rafa's game, different, lefty-righty, all the rest of it. But what's great about Federer is that he didn't go away. Like, it wasn't once it... Like, this is the thing. With the greatest match ever played, 08, everyone said it's the changing of the guard. Caesar on the edge of ruin. 08, it's over. Rafa's taking over. Then the next year, it was one of Roger's best wins against Roddick. Like, it was incredible win in 2009. Ridiculous in that final game. And to me, when someone says, what's your favorite Roger moment, the signature moment, it's the 2017 Aussie Open. He hadn't won a major in 5 years. He hadn't played.
And was down 3-1 in the fifth.
Down 3-1 in the fifth, and he wins five straight games. Are you kidding me?
I was in the, we were doing sports reporters. And so I'm sitting there in the chair with, you know, with Lupica and Album, and I got my phone, and Nadal's up 3-1 in the third, and this match is on while we're taping. And I don't know if that, if it's obvious, I am not listening to anything that's being said during that taping.
Awesome.
And I'm watching it, and I'm like, he's serving 3-1. And I'm like, and that hold. And I'm like, get this hold. And, you know, and I will say that, you know, when that started to slip away, I was like, And I remember, and isn't it funny, Brian, and I'll just finish a sentence. I remember watching that slip away, and that's how you knew it's like, okay, you're a journalist, but you're also a fan. This matters to you. You know this matters to you. And it mattered to me not because it was Fed. And I was never really caught up in the Roger Fed, you know, the Roger Rafa thing because, you know, I don't think like that. I know why the diehards, you know, the Federer diehards can't stand Rafa because of what he, you know, he was the one who took away Roger's invincibility. He's the first one to do it. But on the other hand, I remember watching this and thinking, we spend so much time talking about the beauty and fluidity of Roger. This is a tough motherfucker, boy. I mean, he's a tough dude. I mean, my friend Andrew Burton, I will shout him out, always refers to it as junkyard dog fed. And Adnan, you brought it up earlier about how Roger wants to fight you. He will fight you point for point. Rafa gets the credit for the point thing. Djokovic gets to be the boa constrictor. But try fighting Roger during those years as well.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
And Brian, was it so long ago during that match that John McEnroe was saying, well, if he gets this one, because that was 20, if he gets this one, he's the greatest player of all time?
Well, yeah. And I agree with everything that you're saying about why that mattered. And look, the other thing statistically is it's not like the other two guys are going to have seven more Grand Slams than him. You know, if one of them got to 30, you would have to go, well, that's the greatest. That's, you can't make the, you know, that's it. But it's all in, they are tightly bunched. And we can't separate the aesthetics. You can separate the aesthetics if a player isn't also producing result. But the aesthetics are part of, look, why is Dr. J still considered whatever, the 16th or 17th best basketball player of all time? And by numbers, people find a way to fold the ABA. But what's the real reason? The real reason is because when Dr. J walked onto a basketball court, every single person who ever cared about basketball at all wanted to be there watching him.
You wanted to move the way he moved.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes, exactly. You wanted to look and feel like you could fly and move through down the court with the style and elegance and grace and power that Julius Erving had. I was looking, George Carl posted a picture online today of Bobby Jones and Doc, and it was about Bobby Jones, how he's having Bobby Jones induct him into some Hall of Fame. And I just wrote, you know, Doc wasn't bad either. Like, because when you see, because when you see Doc, you're just like, and if you had asked me, Howard, if you had said to me, hey, Nadal's retiring, hey, Joker's retiring, I would just say, I would have said to you, yeah, I'm certainly like the biggest tennis fan, you know, in these ways, but I have nothing. I can't add that much to that conversation because for whatever reason, I admire them. I think the world of Nadal. I really do. Joker, I personally think it's, you know, I'm not a fan of who I think that guy is or the parts of him that he's letting us see. But Roger's magical. Roger is Magic Johnson. He's Doc. You know, he's all the best parts of the athletes. Otani, like all the best parts of the athletes that are so compelling. To me, anyway.
Yeah, what the players would say when they were playing Federer, they always felt the crowd was against them. Wherever they were, it was always a home game for Roger, wherever he was.
Yeah, wherever he was. And it was funny because I just, when we were talking about this Serena opus I wrote, just to say, you know, I hadn't been to the Open in years. I hadn't been to the Open, you know, since pre-pandemic. And the only thing around the grounds that people were talking about in terms of how it was the most lopsided slam of all time in terms of slams are supposed to be neutral. And you walked in there, and it was very clear if you were Danka Kovanec or if you were Annette Kontaveit or if you were
at those matches. Yep.
You know, if you were Ila Tomljanovic, everybody was against you. And the only thing that people said, this is comparable to a Fed match where nobody wants you to win. They may want to see the match extended, but nobody wants you to win. And, you know, the cheering of the double faults and everything else and all of that stuff is, it's not what you see very often in tennis. Obviously, Australian Open, Nadal, Medvedev, that got a little out of hand. But generally speaking, the slam is supposed to be neutral. This isn't Davis Cup, unless it's Roger.
Yeah, even, you know, you're right, because even though, like, New York loved Johnny Mack, and Johnny Mack is my favorite of all time, like, that's my number one tennis player.
Says the guy who does the Connors doc.
Yeah, it's true. I love Jimmy. Yeah. I mean, it's just true. Part of it was like for a period of time when I didn't like Jimmy, it was because of the way that he and John interacted. I have sympathy for both of them, but I was going to say New York loved Mac and cheered for him, but there were a lot of Borg fans always in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, you would always hear cheering for Borg. Like I worked at the Open when those guys were playing and as a kid and that's just the truth of it. Right. You know, the comp that we're not mentioning, though, and it applies to the grace and elegance and power is Tiger. And mm-hmm. and like all of us know that Tiger is the best golfer. Like you can make the Jack has three more majors.
Yeah, this is my point. The majors isn't
Jack has three more majors. But I'm sorry, Tiger was the best. He just is the best. If he's just the best golfer and you can't hit
whoever
strokes.
Decided that the red shirt on Sunday was going to be a sticker is a genius and deserves a percentage of all of it, because these are the aesthetics we're talking about. The why are we watching? One of my best friends growing up, his father used to wear a red shirt watching Tiger on final weekend, on final Sunday. And I'm like, you're not playing? What's the red shirt going to do for you?
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's why I think the line for Federer, going back to aesthetics, we can argue who the GOAT is, but nobody ever looked better doing it than Roger. Period.
I like Brian's point about how Roger never went away, that there was a shift in him. And it was funny how you talked earlier in the 2000s about how Roger was just running through guys, running through majors, you know, running through all of them except the French, obviously. And then we get into the mid-teens, and now he's an underdog. And there's a bit of a sympathy for him. And let's not forget, you go 2015, you know, the heartbreaking losses here. I mean, 2011, you're on your way to something that never happened. A Rafa Roger final. You were on your way in 2009 as well, right? But Nadal didn't hold up his end in that one. 2015, you get to Roger, 4-23 on break points against Djokovic. Heartbreaking loss. Then you go, of course, to the last Wimbledon final. And these are really, really difficult losses if you're a Roger diehard. Adnan, go.
Yeah, I was going to say 2019, gut-wrenching, Howard. I mean, 4 hours and 57 minutes, you got two match points. And just as I was talking about 2017, Aussie Open was so special, this is 2 years later. Like, oh my God, he's going to do it again. And this is the house of Roger. This is the cathedral. And they're playing forever. And I'm like, oh my God, how is this not happening? And that's the difference. Nadal, you're right. He took away his invincibility. He was a great rival, had a different element to it. But Djokovic was like an irritant, Brian. You're like, damn it, get out of here. Like, enough of this. Like, Roger just couldn't put him away. And it happened in 2014 Wimbledon, 2015 Wimbledon. Like, it was... That's the thing to me. When I look at the 20 majors, it's an incredible, beautiful round number. But it could have been 25. Like, I get greedy. I go, there's a few that squandered him, which also, by the way, makes Roger so likable. It goes back to your point about letting us in a little bit. When he lost to Rafa earlier in his career, then afterwards, you know, tears are coming. Oh, God, this is so hard. Like, you knew how much Roger wanted it. And yet, that fact he was fallible made him even more likable and even more relatable.
When do you remember Roger at Supernova? When you're like, this is, I don't think we're ever going to see, you know, where you're at, you know, David Foster Wallace, it's time to write an entire essay on Roger Federer at Supernova. Yeah, when was the moment for you?
I was going to say, so once the dam breaks in 03 and he beats Philip Poussis, that 04, 05, when he was just bunching up those majors, 3-4 every year, I'm like, okay, this is insane. Like, this guy is invincible. And to your point, how many athletes would you have, the late David Foster Wallace, write an article, Federer as religious experience? Like, literally, you were a devotees of this guy. That's the kind of worship that he inspired. I think that era to me, like, that mid-2000s is awesome because... Again, I appreciate and greatly admire the fact he had the wherewithal to hang in there and the endurance and to last 24 years on tour. But that mid-2000s, I'm like, I've never seen a run like that where he felt like a guy was invincible.
Brian, when was the Supernova moment for you with Roger?
I think it was like I always love, and maybe a part of it is because I'm old, I always love the second half of a great athlete's career. And for me, when they're able to still produce at an incredibly high level, when you know it costs them that much more to do it, you know, the early thing is great. Like, the guy finds out he's as good as he'd hoped. He gets to the majors or the pros or the slam and he can suddenly produce and it's incredible. But, you know, I was playing last night against someone and they were talking about how Alcaraz is like on his way. And I said, you know, it's interesting. I do think Alcaraz has the talent to be the greatest of all time. I said, but you know, also in a year, he could be in a totally different place mentally because becoming number one is an incredibly heavy thing. Being
Absolutely.
The batting champ is an incredibly heavy thing. Leading the league in scoring is a heavy thing. When you're the champ, number one, the heavyweight champ of the world, and you have access to everything you've always wanted and all your dreams have come true, where do you find the hunger, the desire,
well, that's
the discipline,
right.
The focus, the grit, you know, the stories about Jordan every summer getting better. So I think Alcaraz is all those things. And I think he has the right mentors around him. And my sense is that he's going to do it. But until you're in the spot, you don't know, you can't know. And Fed was in the spot and it just made him want it more and he dug
That's
deeper.
Right. Yeah, for me, and I'm like I said, Roger Federer was never my favorite player. I just had an unbelievable, enormous, I mean, how could you not respect Roger Federer? How do you look at this and you go, oh, this is what it's supposed to be. For me, my favorite Federer moment was when he beat Djokovic in 2011 at the French Open, the racket shake, the finger wag, the not done yet, right?
Anywhere.
I mean, that told you that for all the elegance and all the effortlessness, he's here to beat you.
Yeah.
And that was the competitor for me. That was I really enjoyed that moment simply because it gave you a window that you didn't really think you had, right? He never had to give you that window before. And now you could see, because that moment, 2011, they were all passing him. It looked like, you know, it was Nadal and Djokovic, and, you know, Burdick had beaten him at Wimbledon the year before, and he hadn't, you know, people were starting to wonder. And also, it was still during that time period, you know, 12 years ago, when 30 marked the end. So people really were thinking that this is kind of the end. And I agree with you, Brian, that I feel like I have said this over and over again. It is harder today to be a great player than ever before. And the reason is because today you are compensated like a legend. You get the endorsements of a legend. You get the visibility of a legend without being a legend. You don't have to win to earn anymore. You can win a couple tournaments. I mean, look at the guys who are retiring. David Ferrer's gone. Tsonga's gone. Bird. Those guys made $20, $25 million in their career. And so there's a lot of players. I mean, I'm going to go look at Sam Querrey's career earnings. He probably made a good $15 million in his career. Perfectly fine career. So if you're not going to, if you don't have to win to earn the way Martina and Chrissy and Mac and those guys and Connors did, and you're already getting the shine of being a legend like Nick Kyrgios is getting, or Osaka. Naomi Osaka is making $50 million in endorsements. Nick Kyrgios has been to one final, and people talk about him as though he's the future of tennis. Where's the motivation come from to get out there and say, I'm going to compete against history?
And that's part of why, again, I admire Roger for saying, yeah, I could just hang around. It's easy money. People are going to love me. Sponsors will love it. I'm just hanging out. But no, like, there's no point. I don't need to just hang around and, you know, get knocked out in the quarterfinals just to prove my worth, just to prove I'm still in the game. Like, unless I'm here, again, it goes back to cold-blooded temper of Federer. Unless I'm in it to win it, I'm done. I'm just going to assess the situation and I'm good. And I'm like, that is what is admirable about this guy, is that there's no reason to hang on. It's not going to be Ali against Burbick Holmes, right? You're not going to get that moment to say, oh man, look at what's happened to Roger. No way. I'm going out. Yes, Urkacz, that was a tough match at Wimbledon. That stings me that I think of that memory at the All England Club. But I still think of 2019. It wasn't that long ago that Roger was on the verge of winning it. And those memories are indelible.
You know, one thing is that people don't understand, and I know why too. People don't understand the physical cost of a hard tennis match. And the reason is because if we go play pickup hoop, even if we suck, we still have to run up and down the court and defend. And we have to keep, the game works by us going up and down the court. So we understand in some way the physical toll. But if you're not good at tennis, if you're not good enough at tennis to have long, hard rallies, you have no, and you're just kind of recreationally have gone and played doubles, you have no idea what it costs you emotionally and physically at 4-5 in a third set to still like care, to still go like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to try to put a serve in and I have to try to cut. Like it costs so much.
There's no help.
That's
right. The piece of it as well.
Right.
No teammates, no timeouts, no Mariano Rivera to come in and like mop up and finish the job for you. You got to close your own deal. No. And for the sport itself, you know, no taking a knee and running out the clock because you're out of timeouts. You've got to finish the deal.
It's a boxing parallel really works for me because, like, look, your opponent hits a dropper. You got to fucking come in, even if, like, you got to chase down the drop shot and then you got to chase the fucking lob. Mm-hmm. And you know that it's going to kill you for the next 2 points. Like, if you're not in the kind of condition, and it is a really, like, because the game looks effete. Because the game looks genteel, but it is not a genteel game when you play it. It is a fucking war as far as sport. You know, it's not football, but it is a very, very taxing sport to play at a, you know, advanced intermediate level. It's very hard game. And at an expert level, it's just the cost is tremendous. But it is a kind of game that at a below kind of advanced intermediate level, you could play without really getting your heart rate up because you're not having rallies.
That's right.
Yeah. The other thing too, about just the mental toll of it. Remember when replay first came out, Federer was terrible at it because he almost used it as a reaction to get rid of his anger and frustration. Like he was pissed off and go, okay, review it. And he knew he would win it, but it just almost kind of bottom of a second. Like, all right, let me flush that out of the way. Let me regroup and get this. Like, it was amazing to me how quick his memory would be. Like, he wasn't using the replay to get the call right. He was just doing it to refocus, regroup that quickly and recenter and go again.
No, it's true. That's true. Last thoughts, fellas. For me, when I think about this moment, and I do think it's important to consider the moment within its time. You have 2022 looks like one of those demarcating years. You see Nadal get blown off the court by Tiafoe, and afterwards he says, "This is a young person's game, and I am not young." Right? I mean, he's admitting it out loud that he knows that it's time. We haven't seen Djokovic. I still think Djokovic has several years left simply because he hasn't played and he's Djokovic. And but he's also in a time period where the competition is changing around you as well. I think, you see Serena go. Andrea Petkovic is gone. Tsonga is gone. This whole generation of players we've been watching for years, they're all going. Sam Courier retired. Gilles Simon, like all of these guys are going that we've been watching, that they're all retiring now. And of course, the big dogs, Roger, Serena. My prediction is going to be that Rafa is going to say, adios, probably around the French Open next year. That's my guess. I don't see him with one more full 50 match calendar year. I just don't see it. So we're in a moment right now. We're watching an incredible era. 71 of 70 of the last 72 major winners have come from Europe. We're watching a total shift. You've got three guys with 64 majors combined. All right, I'm sorry, 63 majors combined. And it is sort of a farewell period. And I just am interested in your thoughts about reflecting where we are right now in 2022.
Yeah, I think you have to really appreciate this moment in time. And as much as I lament the end of Federer, you appreciate that, the next great thing is coming. And maybe it's Alcaraz, maybe it's someone we haven't even seen yet, but appreciate the greatness as you saw it unfold. And I think to me, I used to always wonder, does Roger Federer think he's the greatest of all time? And I think at some point he knew he was. I don't think now if you ask Roger, you think you're the best? I don't know what kind of answer you're getting out of him. But at one point, he knew he was the best in the world. And that is enough for a lot of athletes to know that, I conquered the mountain. I slayed the dragon. If you want to have these GOAT debates, that's your thing. And to go back to our earlier conversation, I do think there's an absolute over-reliance, over-focus on majors. That should not be the only criteria to determine the best. But I think ultimately for Federer, the best case you can make in terms of his greatness is that people will not remember what you said to them, but they'll remember the way you made them feel. And when you watch Roger Federer, he was inspiring.
And one last thing, Brian, and then Brian, you go. But is that also the case, too? Like, for the tennis watcher, there'll be somebody else who comes along. Is that really true? I think this is going to be a really interesting period to survive. Because I remember when I was a kid, and I would talk about Tony Dorsett, and I would talk about my favorite players. And then the old guys would go, well, if you never saw Jim Brown, you never saw football. Or if you never saw Willie Mays, you never saw it. And how quickly are we going to move? I mean, I don't know if the move on is going to be as clean.
Oh, I think I think you set this up beautifully where I wanted to go, which is if you stay, of course, there are going to be people who are trapped in the way the past made them feel and who will resent things moving on. On the other hand, a couple things. I remember Sampras's last moment, right? We all remember him winning that final major. And if you would have asked Howard, if you would have asked the two of us that day, how long we'd have to wait for someone to come along who we thought was could challenge Sampras for the greatest of all time, we would have said forever. Sampras was like something we'd never seen. I'd been watching tennis so closely for my entire life, and we never saw something like Pete Sampras, right? Agassi was my favorite player of that era. And I loved him so much. And I watched him so closely. And this, guy had the best, the best ground strokes of all time in some ways, Agassi. And it just didn't matter because Pete changed tennis. And then 2 minutes later, these f-ing guys came along. And you really can't slot.
And it really Sampras. Was 2 minutes later. It was like,
you really can't slot Sampras higher than four on the all-time list. Like you just cannot put him. I tried to make the argument as recently as 3 years ago, but now there's no making the argument. He's fourth. Like, it's just, that's it.
And one of the reasons why you can't is because these new guys, starting with Roger and Rafa, and of course Novak, who is, to me, as complete a player as you'll ever see, they made it a four-surface game. They made it a four major game.
They just made it. Yeah, they did. They made it very, look, Agassi won all four, but they made it very clear that they are the three best who ever played the game. But what that tells me is that, like, if Alcaraz keeps his head, like, it's fine. I checked my, cause you never want to be like, oh, I just noticed this. But like, I sent Bomani a text 9 months ago and I was like, are you up on Alcaraz? And he was like, who's that? And I said, he's.
But you ask him, Bomani, about
he's going to be number.
Yeah, Bomani,
I said he's
going
to. I mean, we just talk all the time, you know. I was like, I want to, because that reason. I was like, you talk about sports all the time. I want to put you up on the best tennis player. So I was like, watch this kid Alcaraz, and I found the text and I resent it to him yesterday. Like, I always just know, don't I? And he was like, yeah, I didn't doubt it. I went and looked. I figured it out. But just to say, Alcaraz really could end up being that. Alcaraz could end up being that person. And I'll say this. If you would have asked me, I would have said I would never care about a baseball player in the way I cared about Reggie Jackson. But Ohtani, as a 56-year-old man, Ohtani brought me back to baseball. I care so much about
him. Well, and that's why
that's why tennis will survive this.
That's right, and it will. And that's the reason why, like, I'm the exact opposite. It will make all of you guys laugh, but I was a Lendl guy when I was a kid. He was my guy.
You're just a contrarian. That's insane.
Just a contrarian, right? I was a Lendl guy. And I'll tell you why I was a Lendl guy. It was because I'm a nice person. It was because of compassion. Right. It was because there was one match, laughing. There was one match where Lendl lost. I don't remember which one it was. It was clearly pre-84, pre-French 84. And in his runner-up speech, he said, one day it would be nice if the crowd rooted for me. And that just broke me as like an 11-year-old. I was like, I want you to win. I didn't realize that you actually hit the ball directly at people and you're not a nice person at all. But I didn't know those things at the time. I want you to win. So Lendl was my guy. And obviously French Open 84, everything changes. But when you talk about what brings you back into the sport, I was not a Sampras guy. I thought the game has been out of balance. And one of my biggest fears about tennis is that it's going back out of balance, that guys aren't going to return anymore. And it's becoming very, very ace heavy. And that no one is really paying attention to the, you know, because the guys are so damn tall now that the game is completely out of balance. And that's why you cannot, I repeat, you cannot take five sets away from majors. Because you're going to have
I would be heartbroken if that happened, yeah.
But for me, what brought me into the game was watching Roger rack up all the majors. And I was in the opposite category because I'm a Bird, Magic, Celtics, Lakers guy. And I was like, I want to see somebody stand up to Roger. And then I saw Nadal and that major. You know, and those two, that rivalry brought me back into the sport and I haven't left it. It's not because I hated Roger or I loved Rafa. It was, we got two guys who are going to duke it out for the next 10 years and this is what I'm here for. I'm an, you know, Ali Frazier, yeah, that's what we're here for, man. That's what, I want to see dominance on both ends. Give me Cowboys, 49ers, that's it. And so to have that and to have had that, and I disagree with you, Brian, that you will have something to add because next year when Rafa, you know, hangs it up, we're going to do this again and have a similar conversation.
Well, I'll always show up for you. And obviously, yeah, I could. I'm just saying the poetry is different with.
Yeah, completely.
Roger, that's all. It's a
And we will end this on. I'm sorry, Adam, you got one last thing.
One thing I promise. I just want to say thank heavens for Robin Soderling. Federer beats him the 09 French Open. If he hadn't won that French Open, you know, people would argue, well, never went on all surfaces, even though he was the second best clay court player in the world. He just couldn't beat Rafa three straight.
And you can still make the argument that he may still be. I think I would put Novak ahead of him because, you know, he's got, you know, the French Opens, but I would put him. Roger easily top three of all time on clay, and he's got one French Open. And I will end this with two movie guys, the way that we're going to combine these two things. Thank you guys for joining me. And I will say, to quote McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I got poetry in me. Roger had a lot of poetry in him, and we were very appreciative of that. Thank you, boys. We'll see you soon. This was Meadowlarkers 47. Next week, we'll have Kate Fagan and Amin El Hassan back with us. But for now, this was tennis.
Talk soon. Bye.
Robert Altman, baby.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.